Burns. This is Severin. It is Thursday, 2 o'clock. We are here. Today I am in Connecticut, and it's overcast but not raining, which is great because we just transplanted 2,000 tomatoes. And frankly, they might have gotten the blight as early as today. Well, that was our major paranoid fear, but we are no longer paranoid because it is spring and it is not raining. And I am thrilled today to be joined on the phone by my wonderful friend Judith Winfrey down in Georgia near Atlanta. Judith, are you there?
Hi, Severin, I'm here. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you here. Oh, nice to hear your voice. Now, Judith, will you mind, please, just introducing yourself and your various affiliations, and then we'll start unpacking those affiliations.
Sure. So my name is Judith Winfrey, and I am a farm partner with my sweetheart, Joe, at a farm called Love is Love. We're right in the suburbs of Atlanta, Georgia, and we have about 5 acres under organic vegetable production. We also have 100 or so laying hens, and that is the majority of what we're producing is eggs and vegetables. And I do lots of work in the community. I'm a community organizer. I'm the leader of Slow Food Atlanta, and I am also working with the Wholesome Wave Foundation here in Georgia to double the value of nutrition assistance dollars spent at farmers markets. I manage a farmers market called the East Atlanta Village Farmers Market, and do basically anything I can to get good food to as many people nearby as possible.
It's what they call a food movement busybody.
Yeah, I think that's a good word for me. I was called inexhaustible in the Atlanta Journal and Constitution last week, and I submitted a correction. I wanted them to know that I am actually often quite exhausted.
It's exhausting in the spring, especially when there's just so much to do.
Yeah. We've had a beautiful spring here. It's really been encouraging because, you know, last fall we were flooded pretty badly, and it's been a nice rebound to have beautiful, cool weather and a little bit of rain, just the right amount. It's been great.
So you had a nice, easy entry, and it didn't get blazing early hot.
Exactly. We're still having 60-degree nights here, which is a big deal for us in May.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the flood. But before the flood, let's move back before the flood. Before there was a flood, you weren't even a farmer yet. And neither was Joe, and you were just sweethearts. Let's start there.
Okay. So we met working at a really great beer joint in Atlanta called the Brick Store Pub. And I immediately fell in love with this man because he was the hardest working man I had ever seen. I was like, wow, he works really hard. And that turns out to be a great thing for the profession that we found ourselves in. We got interested in food activism through Food Not Bombs. Joe especially was doing a lot of gleaning and cooking and taking food around, and then we started thinking that it would be nice to know how to actually produce the food. So Joe went to work on a farm, and from there we fell in love with the meaning of the work and the importance of doing something with your hands that your heart could also be a part of, and the floodgates kind of opened from there. I started working for an organization called Georgia Organics that is doing sustainable agriculture advocacy in our state, and I was there when a farmer came in to the office and said He was looking to retire, and he wanted somebody to manage the farm, and that was kind of our opportunity, and we seized it because we felt it was really important to prove that young people who don't own land can farm and can make a living doing it. And we've been doing that for the last 3 years.
So you were sitting there in the office at the right time, and then you pounced on the opportunity and moved out into, is it, what do we call it, exurbs of Atlanta?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's really the suburb of Atlanta. It's a sprawling suburban community with strip malls and fast food restaurants and subdivisions everywhere, and we're really on what feels like the last little farm in the middle of subdivisions and malls.
And the runoff of those subdivisions and malls, the water runs off of those malls and those subdivisions, and it affects the way that the water moves across the land. Let's talk, maybe tell us about the flood.
All right. Well, the farm is bordered on one side by a body of water called the Anawake. It's a creek, but it's a largish creek, and it's a tributary of the biggest river in Georgia, which is the Chattahoochee, and we are really just about a quarter of a mile from where the Anawake meets the Chattahoochee. So, in some beautiful bottomland. In September, we had nearly 20 inches of rain in 24 hours. It was an amazing storm, and I think because we're in what people around here call a holler, just a little dip between two hills, storm systems seem to stay right on top of us, and they certainly did that night. It was a really crazy storm. It kept us up all night. We knew something bad was gonna reveal itself in the morning, but we had no idea that we would wake up to pretty much our entire farm under about 5 feet of water, and not just water standing, but a moving current that pulled down hundreds of trees and took almost all of our topsoil with it. And yes, you're absolutely right. If we hadn't been surrounded by all of these impervious surfaces, I don't think that we would have seen the extreme amount of flooding that we saw. The Chattahoochee came up about 30 feet and stayed up for about a week. We didn't see our crops again for 4 days after that flood. And when the water went down, we saw our topsoil was gone. There were golf balls everywhere because there's a golf course right up the river, or right up the creek from us. And then we had to figure out what to do. What do you do when it was fall? It was September, like really the first day of fall. So all of our fall crops had just gone in. And we lost everything. And so there we were with, like, no income and a giant mess to clean up and employees who needed the work. And we had to figure out what to do, Severin. So we kind of mobilized the community. And then we started thinking, oh, I bet there's other farmers that have been impacted. And there were. And it turned out there were about a dozen small farms in Georgia that had severe flooding and lost crops and animals. Many lost livestock. And through Slow Food Atlanta and some the cooperation of Georgia Organics and a few other organizations, we were able to have a fundraiser to help everybody at least stabilize and get through the fall and winter, which was really cool.
So that was basically a big community Band-Aid that you were able to put on a big bleeding wound. It wasn't quite maybe big enough of a Band-Aid, but it was a community Band-Aid made possible by your history in the community and the relationships around food, and probably was deeply encouraging, but probably you wouldn't have another Band-Aid if you needed it.
No, probably not. And I will say that, you know, in the very beginning, one of the things I learned from the disaster that was really helpful and I will take forward wherever I go is you have to act really quickly when something like that happens. I mean, you have to start documenting it and taking pictures and getting the message out immediately. And there's some reticence to do that because people think, oh, well, some agency will come in and take care of everything. And there were definitely people who said, you know, FEMA's going to be there for you or the USDA is going to be there for you. And while that's true to some extent, they were there really, really slowly. We're still waiting on the assistance that the USDA offered, and it wouldn't have gotten us through the fall and winter because of the timing, but even the amount was not very much. So yes, there was a big community Band-Aid, and it was incredibly helpful for a lot of people, but I don't know what will happen if there's another disaster, because you do wonder, like, how much do people have to give and how willing are they to be there again and again? Because as you know, it feels like there could be a disaster every year with a small farm.
Well, and particularly when the weather's all wobbly and so many things are wobbly and everybody's
yeah,
like pushing themselves on the phone a little bit, that in the context of that wobble becomes ever clearer why we need to have resilient, biologically diverse, diversified, structurally sound farm businesses and farm communities, because it's that structural integrity that will allow us to have the bounce we need to deal with, the heartache that happens, if not yearly, then at least occasionally.
Absolutely.
There's something there to learn about, you know, when once we've allowed the ecosystem or the farmscape, the kind of farm community ecosystem, to get all fracturized and, you know, developed into strip malls, that we don't only lose, you know, the clean, you know, view across the land, and we don't only lose, you know, the density of culture of the kids in school all understanding themselves as farmers, but you also lose
resiliency.
Well, you lose resiliency, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like you have to be particularly brave to, you know, knowing that, to say, okay, we're working in a system that is right now deeply compromised, but we understand that, and we're working towards, you know, rebuilding it. And so that's why it's so wonderful to have someone as smart as you, as busybody as you, with that insight. But what are you doing with that insight? Or, like, let's talk about how that piece of sand in your oyster is getting a pearl around it.
Well,
uh-oh. That was a hard question,
no.
I'm sorry.
No, it's a good question. I mean, to be honest with you, a lot of, so, you know, whenever anyone is faced with any kind of crisis, you have to respond immediately and quickly, and that's what I was saying, that was a lesson learned, that you have to do that. And then there's a period of time where you just kind of have to stabilize and evaluate and decide how you're going to move forward. And really, it's like a recovery process. And to a great extent, I feel like that's still where we are. So that seed is still germinating, so to speak. I'm not sure exactly what I have to offer from the experience, except that I've had the experience and that I certainly am happy to be a voice of reason when people say things like, well, that was a 500-year flood and it's not going to happen again for 500 years. I just don't know that I believe that, and I think it's important to be the person to say loudly anywhere I can, I'm not sure. I don't think any of us really know what the climate is going to do anymore, so I'm not sure that things like 500-year floods are predictable for the next little while. And I have found that in the community, we have become a resource for people who are going through their own crises. You know, we had friends in North Georgia who were hit by a tornado in November, and I was one of the first calls they made, and it felt good to me to be able to leverage the terrible experience I had to help get them on the road to recovery that much sooner. And the same with some friends in Nashville who were just flooded. You know, they called, what do we do? What is the first step? And it felt good to at least be able to say what I had learned and offer what experience I could.
And there was Judith with her flood club, ready to institutionalize the mutual suffering of many people for the empowerment and emotional stability of all. And by the way, if you need another one for your flood club, Snow's Bend Farm in Alabama, they just got really badly flooded, too. They're in the crook of the Black Warrior River.
Yes.
And they could join the flood club.
Oh, yeah. Well, they were some of the first flood club members. They were flooded several years ago. I'm sorry to hear that they've been flooded again. Is that a repercussion of everything that happened in Tennessee?
Well, I was just down there. We were filming in Alabama and in Mississippi, and we were driving, and we were talking, and we were looking, and this is about 2 months ago. This is right after we saw each other in D.C., That's another flood.
Holy moly.
Dear radio listeners, this is Greenhorns Radio. We are talking about the flood club with Judith Winfrey from Love is Love Farm in Georgia. She has other stories she could tell, but the flood story is one that I think is important for us to all really hear because why is it important? It is important because it is reality, and our rosy-cheeked protagonism and our ferocious need to feed the people who we live near and our creative capitalism and our brave muscles are all well and good, but when the weather keeps wobbling, it's just something to know that you have to really have a lot of systems in place.
I can add to that that, you know, here we were, and when we were flooded, it was our second year of farming. And as everybody who farms on a small scale, well, farms at all, knows, it takes a tremendous amount of stamina and fortitude and heart and courage to run a farm in the first place. So it kind of feels unfair when a disaster happens on top of that.
Because by September, you're already pretty tired.
Yeah, exactly. So I think part of what's important about the story is just we weren't prepared. We hadn't really even thought about what would we do if there was some huge disaster that we had to respond to. Because in a way, when you're farming, part of what we're doing is trying to rebuild a relationship with the earth for the people around us and for ourselves. And we feel like we're responding in a small way to disaster every day. So when this other huge disaster comes on, it's beyond overwhelming. And I don't want anyone to feel paranoid or afraid, but I do want to offer courage and the benefit of the experience that it can happen. Create things that are crazier than even blight and cucumber beetles can happen anytime.
Can happen anytime, and this is an important thing for us to take into account, and to remember why it's so important to go into this process of being a farmer with as much planning and preparation as you can, with a business plan that has room for mistakes and for drama and for disasters, big and small, and with, you know, a real serious long-term commitment to addressing those issues as they inevitably show up. I think that, you know, when something serious happens, it reminds us all that, you know, how very seriously we have to, you know, take this job that we've chosen.
Absolutely.
But now there's other things also that we should learn about, because in fact there's so much going on in Georgia that is strong, and there's such an incredible community around food that's growing down there, and new farmers starting up all the time. So maybe let's give, you know, we know about the Flood Club, but there's some other stuff happening in Georgia that's super positive, and I think people who are unfamiliar with the scene down in ATL and its surroundings would probably enjoy a little rundown.
All right. Well, thank you, because as you know, one of my meta missions is to make the Southeast as visible, you know, in the sustainable ag movement as our friends in the Northeast and the West Coast seem to enjoy, because there is, in fact, a tremendous amount happening. We have... we are certainly not as far along as other places, but in a way that makes it more exciting, because we're growing, and we're growing quickly. We're taking on new farmers and new farmland all of the time, and a lot of young farmers are moving in to family land, to other farmers' land. Georgia is the third largest ag state in the country. A lot of people don't realize this. And there's a tremendous amount of farmland, and there's a lot of farmland in South Georgia that I kind of drool over, because that's really where ag is happening, and we're starting to see some movement and the development of organic farms and small farms are they're growing down there, and that's exciting. We have is there somebody
can I interrupt you for a second? Will you tell a little phrase about what mostly is growing in Georgia? Pines, peaches, what is it?
Well, a lot of that ag, what makes us the third largest ag state in Georgia, in the country, is chicken. There are a lot of chicken houses in Georgia. We're also growing a tremendous amount of, our big specialty crops are watermelon, sorghum,
peaches,
some corn. What's
peaches
that?
And pecan. What I heard was peaches, pecans, pine, poultry, and shoot. That's why I wanted you to do it, but I didn't work. Oh well, we lost it.
Sorghum. We definitely grow a lot of sorghum, and peaches are not as big as they once were. But yes, we are growing a lot of peaches here.
Oh yeah, peanuts. That was it. That was the last one. Oh
yeah. We don't have a lot of organic peanuts being produced, although there is an amazing farmer in Screven, Georgia, named Raylinda Walker, who produced the first crop of organic peanuts. She's growing on about just 40 acres down there. There's so many amazing young farmers. I don't know if there's somebody you want me to mention specifically, if you had your mind fixed on.
I don't have my mind on anybody. There's wonderful. There's the wonderful Jenny Jack farmers who are. If those of you who don't know about mules, a Jenny is a girl donkey, not a girl mule.
Right.
And a Jack is a male. Can you have a female mule? Yes, you can. That's just going to be sterile. Oh, dear. This is what happens when we get all off topic. We get really silly.
So there's Chris and Jenny Jackson at the Jenny Jackson Farm in Pine Mountain, and they are amazing. We Joe and I were lucky enough to partner with them for the last 2 years to for our CSA, and that was a real treat. Though now it's exciting, a huge development for them. They are able to market everything they grow within 30 miles of their farm. So they don't have to come to the city anymore to sell, which has always been their goal, and we were all sort of surprised by how quickly they were able to meet it. So demand in more rural areas is growing too, which is exciting to see. There's Paige at Serenby that is a really fabulous farmer, and one of the things I like is that so many of the farmers that we know and we work with closely are working in different models. Not all of them are working on land they own. Chris and Jenny are growing on her dad's land, and Paige is working for this development that wanted a farm as the centerpiece, as you know. And I think, you know, if there's one issue that I feel really passionately about right now, and I know you have done a lot of work on yourself, Severin, is land tenure and taking care of yourself as a young farmer on land that you don't own. It's imperative in the planning process and the working it out process to make sure that you have yourself protected so that you can't, so that what you're working hard to build can't be taken away from you.
I just wanted to echo that and tell everybody, because on September 29th, we're having a stakeholder forum in the Hudson Valley, and the title of it is called Land Access for Beginning Farmers in the Hudson Valley. And we've invited Judith to come and speak. And it's funded, actually, by Cooperative Extension, because Cooperative Extension knows that this is a really big sticking point, is, you know, when there's eagerness on both sides at the beginning to get involved in the farm startup, that's one thing. But then getting security in that relationship, legal security for both parties, And frankly, kind of communication stability, like having a harmonious long-term relationship. That's something that is really integral to that equation and difficult to communicate, especially, you know, when you're young and prickly and punky and feeling all these yeoman feelings. Those feelings are not necessarily so harmonious in every case with the value set that the landowner, and a landowner who may not be familiar with agriculture, is going to bring to that equation.
Even if they are familiar with agriculture, it's farming is so personal, and there really are many ways to do it and do it right. You may not agree on the right way to do it, even if they do have agricultural experience. And you need to be prepared for how to work out those kinds of disagreements. I've found through my experience that farming someone's land is way more personal than I ever would have expected it to be. That in a way, you have you're developing a relationship with the farm, and you're developing a relationship with, I liken the landowner to like the parent of the farm or the mother of the farm. You know, it's like you have to be respectful of the people who own the farm and respectful of the farm, and you have to figure out a way to be in that sort of triangulated relationship that works for you too. And it's not as simple as one would think. There are many complications and there are many nuances, and it takes a tremendous amount of sensitivity and patience, and I would say as much as you can think through in the beginning the better off you'll be.
And, you know, this is coming from Judith, who's one of the most bright, sunshine, pure-intentioned ladies that I know. And she's so thoughtful about these things, and so it's really wonderful to hear you kind of problematize a process. Because, you know, ultimately, the process of converting our agricultural system over to a more sustainable system with more stakeholders and more producers and more vendors and more processors and more farms, it's a process, and that process is complicated. And as you're explaining, it takes really intense focus on the part of a whole group of different players, each of whom coming into that set of relationships with a different background. And you're also making this point, just a different style and a different set of prejudices, because so much of a farm really is, it's the farm as an institution is just kind of built up of 20 years of instinct, that instinct translates into how things are done and how things look and how the trees are pruned and what kinds of spacings and what kinds of rotations and how we put back up our tractor and all these things.
Mm-hmm.
And you wouldn't necessarily think going in that that would be complicated, but as you found, as many, frankly, many people are finding, having figuring that out is quite a learning experience. What would make it easier, Judith? That's a question.
I think what would make it easier is, A, the recognition that that is going to happen. I know I keep falling back on this metaphor of relationship, but it really is. It is relationship. And it's just like falling in love. You know, everything seems great in the beginning. And then, you know, one day you're like, wow, I didn't realize that they talk that much in the morning or whatever the thing is. And so these little pet peeves start to develop. And so if people have reasonable human relationship skills, it's helpful. That makes it easier. But I think also going into it knowing that there will be a day where there will be a conflict about something that you didn't expect, and you need to know how to be prepared for it. And asking as many questions as possible up front. I mean, what I've thought about doing, and maybe someday when I have a little time I will do, is a sort of a checklist that will allow two farmers who are thinking of working together in any way, but particularly in a land owner, land tenant kind of a way, some sort of checklist that will allow them to have a guided conversation about what their values are, what they like, what they don't like, to help people think through all of those little details. I think it would be incredibly important to have that conversation in the beginning, and it would make everything easier.
Yeah, I think we got to figure out how to give you space to do that checklist, Judith. Well, it's all still fresh in your mind. Maybe we're going to have to kidnap you up north for a weekend and give you some nice tea and a quiet
my
corner.
My Yankee vacation.
We'll just take you a little. We'll put you in a cell. Now, okay, so this is good, and we basically don't have any more time to talk about this, but I think we may have to come back to Judith, because the next chapter, like, we're at the question, and we've kind of, like, grown our horns out, you know, kind of antagonizing and thinking and problematizing and analyzing it, and now we have to hitch our horns to the plow and figure out where the furrow lies and how to best apply our lesson to future making. And so what I want to say is maybe we can schedule to do that next session in a couple months when the formative spring thinking phase has developed into a small bud, and then we can start developing that fruit. That was
that
a lot of
great
metaphors. Woo! But it's okay. So that's where we're going to leave it. Is there any announcements that you have about what people who are interested in anything that you've said could tune into, or where the most resources lie that you're excited about sharing with the world?
Well, you know, I think you've done a tremendously good job of assimilating information for everybody. So I would send them to your website for farming information, especially for young and beginning farmers. But I am really passionate about this Wholesome Wave project right now, and I do want to encourage people to look into the Wholesome Wave Foundation and see if there are markets in their area that are doubling EBT and WIC dollars, because I think it's a powerful program, and it's really sort of addressing the crux of food access and this idea that this is an elitist movement, and I'm really proud of the work they're doing, so I would like to put a little plug in for them.
Okay, good plug. Good people. And for, you know, this is a plug. We're talking about the plugging the hole of this problem, leaky problem of our system, which is that people who cannot afford fresh food access are people who really need fresh food access, and we don't have the political frameworks quite yet in place to get them that access. But if we prove that it's possible to improve diets through these kinds of WIC, fresh fruit through WIC and through food stamps, EBT cards, then we can model the solution. And then in the next farm bill, and as the programs are evolving within the government itself, they can just redesign the program to fix the problem. Is that accurate?
Exactly. That's what they can do.
That's what we can do. We'll have to do it together. And, Judith, thank you for your patience. I got a little rambly, but thank you all for your listening. Thank you to Judith. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's really good. I'm so looking forward to seeing you in September. Thank you to our sponsors, to Hearst Family Ranch out in California, and HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Okay. See you next.
Bye.
Bye.